This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Business Masterclass. First half of the hour will be our business skills conversation in association with USB Ed. Last week we talked about uncertainty tolerance, that tolerance for pain and challenges of business. Today's theme is all about creating a sustainable competitive advantage, what to consider. Joining me in studio is our guest, Ian Shipley. Welcome, Ian.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great. Thanks for being with us. So this whole question about a competitive advantage, I mean, we've heard the terms the SCA, I mean, that's a sustainable competitive advantage. Why is it important for an entity? I mean, why even bother?
I think unless you're thinking in that space, I think you're going to be history before you know it. I think there's understandably such forces in the market out there, and if you're going to stand out as unique and with a different offer, I think it's going to have to be forefront in your mind.
Okay. So, I mean, what are some of the characteristics or things that you need to worry about from a sustainable competitive advantage perspective?
Let's dive in with the one that many of us are familiar with, and that is with brand. So if we take some of the household brands of our day, if you take Apple per se, I think if I had to say what comes to mind when I mention the word Apple, it conjures up a lot of images as you pull it out your pocket.
As I pull out my Apple iPhone and open and my Apple your, my Apple Air, yeah.
I see your Apple Air, your MacBook there. So that has become a brand, and actually they're actually fans that follow that now. So you'll have certain people who will be getting two new iPhones a year and keeping up with the latest trend of everything. So
they don't upgrade when the contract expires, they upgrade when the phone is up for an upgrade in terms of the brand.
Absolutely. So they'll figure out a way to trade it in or do that. So I think, you know, when you get to a name like Apple, Coca-Cola, as we've commonly started saying in the last number of years, don't go onto the web and look for it. We just say Google it. So that's a brand.
That's a brand. So brand plays an important part in terms of creating that competitive advantage. Because, I mean, fundamentally, what's the difference between the Apple brand and, for example, a Samsung? I mean, they're both, I can take a phone call, I can get my email, I can take a photo. But the brand seems to have an impact on the value people perceive and what they're prepared to pay. And I can pretty much guarantee that the price of an Apple phone is significantly more than a Samsung phone, for example. Yet both have great brands.
Absolutely. So I guess there's some deciding factors out in the market, and one is economic, in the sense that some people maybe cannot afford or get close to the Apple brand. But when you are in a position or are prepared to make sacrifices to get into that place, I think a number of extraordinary things come to mind with Apple. One is its simplicity. One is its stylish. I moved to a PC a few years ago, but I was chatting with my wife just the other day, and she said, you know, my MacBook hasn't been in for repair in 5 years. So there's also something about the quality
aspect. So there's something that a brand stands for, and I think often we forget that. We go, oh well, Coca-Cola or Apple, and we go, well, they're just the brand. But when you think about it, I mean, and you're right, you know, how often are you taking that Apple MacBook or whatever it may through to the repair center, versus how many times are you taking your Dell or your other piece of normal, let's call it PC software or PC hardware through to your supplier for something to be fixed. So that's it's interesting that you raise that, because there's almost, let's call it, an underpin that perhaps people ascribe to brand that is actually an underpin of something more than just a name. It's actually the quality, the user experience, etc. I mean, the reality is, if anybody picks up an iPhone, everybody knows you click the little thing at the bottom and you'll get the screen to come on. I mean, it's just known. In fact, most other phones are now imitating that kind of capability, the one-touch button at the bottom, and most people have become synonymous with, well, that's how you access, because Apple created the access point at the bottom of the bottom center of the screen, and everybody else now feels almost obligated to follow the Apple standard of putting it on one button in the middle of the phone on the bottom. So, I mean, and I guess that maybe gets us to this, the next comment of what's this principle of, you know, let's call it the network effect from a competitive advantage perspective. I mean, effectively, everybody has seen how an iPhone works with the bottom, the button center bottom. Now there's a bit of a network effect because other suppliers are effectively copying that type of type of thinking. So, you know, they have now by implication created a competitive advantage because now everybody's using the button at the center of bottom of the screen, almost reinforcing their position from a competitive advantage perspective. Is my understanding correct?
Yeah, I think they're different. Angles you can look at the network one from. One of the ones that is constantly cited as one of the world leaders is eBay.
Okay.
So if you take online auctioneering,
okay,
and so I think that the upside for them is that they can attract more sellers and buyers, they're both benefiting in a huge way, and if they can then put on complementary aspects to the business, such as the PayPal option. Mm-hmm. eBay had some competitors some time back, but have taken a considerable advantage, especially in North America and some of the Western world, just with the association with their product as well.
So just that critical mass of the network, almost, let's call it, overwhelms and creates that competitive advantage of, if you're not there, you're not part of it. I guess Airbnb has also kind of gone the same route. I mean, there are lots of other B&Bs out there, but
yeah.
Bottom line now, if you're not on Airbnb, are you actually on at all? I guess, you know, running your own website, going through all the pain, just Airbnb it.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, there's another good example of how they've used that critical mass of that network to make it almost impossible to compete standalone, I guess.
Absolutely. And I think going back to your original question is of how important is competitive advantage. If we just track as recently as 2 decades ago, many of the booksellers just stood and watched passively for a few years when these new kids on the block, Amazon, arrived. Mm. And if you've been privileged to travel to Europe or the States in recent times, you'll see large-scale, magnificent bookshops just closing by the hundred because they thought that someone would always take the time to come and browse in their store. But the Amazon guys knew that they could offer something quicker, a bigger offer than you could house in one local store. And while others slept, they took the market.
Yeah. So that competitive advantage often, it would appear, comes from thinking a little differently about the business model. But once you're there, really kind of getting it to fly and getting it going the full route. Then what about patents? I mean, do you not need to and clearly Amazon didn't patent what they did. They just did it so well so quickly that it became a scenario of no one could really copy them. And I think there are many other examples where people haven't moved to protect their, let's call it, their choices that they've made because it's just been so hard to copy. But what's the role of patents nowadays in terms of your competitive advantage? You know, patenting that secret sauce, you know, the secret sauce, the secret recipe, you know, is that still needed?
I think, yeah, that's a secret recipe. Coca-Cola comes to mind. But,
yeah.
And I think they still do play a role. And I guess there's a temptation to not consider them adequately because of the speed with which change and shifts are taking place. But that patent can protect that competitive advantage for a season. We do realize that there will be copycats out in the market, and it'll just be a matter of time going back to your iPhone before someone else is doing something similar. But I think it does protect the guys who are first into the water and into the game, and hopefully you can keep that competitive advantage if you can stay ahead of your competitors.
Now, I mean, when we talk of patents, I also think, you know, to myself, sometimes there's the, let's call it the legislative patent, and then there's also almost like, let me call it an intuitive or intrinsic, maybe not patent, but just the way you do things. So, for example, anywhere you go in the world, everybody knows what an iStore looks like. Because it looks the same, it has the same look and feel, it's got that, let's call it, that unique corporate identity. And I will never forget the comment of not too far back, there were a whole lot of iStores that had been opened in China, but Apple didn't have any iStores in China, only to discover that everything down to the floor tiles and the way the stock was packed had been copied very nicely. And in fact, the sad part was the employees working in the store actually did think they worked for Apple until they were told. So, you know, sometimes you think to yourself, well, the patent works, and, you know, it works well, but anything can be copied. Now, I mean, what about know-how? I mean, patents and know-how. I mean, that critical element. I mean, I have had scenarios where you hear people saying they're going to have to remove the part numbers off this piece of equipment when they assemble it so that it can't be copied. And, you know, back in the day, you used to have people removing part numbers, etc., from electronics because there was, you know, to try and hide exactly what was going on inside the black box, so to speak, you know, and you know, is that still a source of advantage nowadays? I mean, the know-how inside a business, how critical is that?
Again, I think complementary to the patent, if one is finding a quicker route to do something that delivers consistent quality, that know-how also gives you an inside track on things. So I think the know-how, citing Google as an example, when you just look at how they have motivated people to place content up, but have attracted the content writers, but placing most of the emphasis on the advertiser paying for space. I think they've got to know how it works here.
And I suppose fundamentally the know-how of, for example, like the Google algorithms. I mean, that fundamentally is a real source of their competitive advantage. Nobody can, you know, re-Google. And it's quite interesting. I recently was in China and had this experience with the firewalls in place, etc., where Google didn't work the way I thought it would work. And I found myself a little lost because I'm so used to, I think we all are so used to, just, you know, whatever we need, www.google, and you ask the question and you get the answer. And then all of a sudden, that route to solutions was no longer open to me, and I didn't know what to do. I was like, well, what search engine am I going to use if Google's not working in China? And obviously, not speaking Chinese, it's a little hard to use one of the generic Chinese search engines. But yeah, it was, you know, I think I gained a new appreciation for how reliant we become on that know-how and knowing that it'll just work. So don't worry about it. You know, Google will just always work. And then you kind of go, well, it doesn't. And you go, like, my goodness, what do I do now? You know, like I always say, you know, it's BG, you know, what did you do before Google? I don't know. Now, I mean, scale, does that also, I mean, we've talked a bit about the large companies. Does scale automatically give you competitive advantage?
Yeah, so now we're looking at a different end of the market. So I guess we started off our conversation, not that Apple aren't doing mega scale, but so obviously you've got your niche and your upper end product. But if you're taking our South African brands of the Pick and Pays and the ShopRites and the others, definitely the scale is giving you a competitive advantage. So if you have that large scale and accessibility, you can come down and reduce your costs considerably.
So the whole principle of, you know, buy low, sell high type of scenarios. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, your traditional retailer, you know, if let's take it like a Walmart versus a traditional South African retailer. The reality is Walmart is buying at a fraction of the price that a South African retailer would be, because they're buying on a global scale and global volume. So scale does create competitive advantage, I guess. And it would be difficult for somebody who wasn't that size to get that same price with many of the supplier base. But what happens if you just don't have scale at that sort of, let's call it that end of the spectrum? I mean, Walmart's an absolutely incredible example of mass scale. I mean, just the principle of doing something more often than your competitors, does that give you an advantage or a disadvantage?
Give me an example of what you're thinking about the frequency there.
So, I mean, you know, for example, if you've got a scenario where, you know, you've got something that you produce as a company and, you know, it's used, perhaps there's a few thousand items out there in the market, and you happen to be able to produce for that demand fairly easily and effectively versus somebody who's perhaps, you know, not tooled appropriately and producing it just, you know, odd lots and having to almost custom make. So I guess it's that trade-up between custom designed and built versus almost, let's call it, a mass production type of environment. Does that give you enough to be competitively sustainable?
I think that's it's one that I'm just considering at the moment. There, can I go back to your one on the Walmart?
Can I come in on the scale?
Yeah,
while you chew on that one. I mean, have you seen the strategy of Macro?
Mm-hmm.
It's big.
Yeah.
And I actually had several just one-on-one conversations with the CEO, Doug Jones. And they had their offsites, their strategy sessions as an executive team. And they said, what makes us unique? I guess, what's our competitive advantage? What do we have that no one else has? And they just realized it doesn't matter what they say or do, it comes back to the word big.
Mm.
So you now see they say big on life.
Mm.
Big on food, big on everything is big. And I guess that's another word for scale.
Mm.
Maybe not all the elements, Richard, of scale, but
but
does that give them competitive advantage, the fact that they're so big? And it certainly looks to me like more and more it does. I mean, they've got this massive premises and they're putting everything under there, and they manage to do it fairly quality.
Mm.
And suddenly even their own brand game, which is in the same stable, looks, in my view, almost awful. You go into a game store and you don't enjoy being there, but you go into Macro and you actually enjoy the scale. So they've taken big or scale to another level. Well, game is supposed to be in the same category, but you don't get the same feeling. It's become a competitive advantage for Macro.
And what I'm trying to get at is, and contrast that with the scenario of almost, let's call it, bespoke, customized production or items. So I don't have something that's like mass produced. It's kind of customized just for me, and it gives me exactly what I want, exactly what I'm looking for. You know, let's take an audio system like a Bang & Olufsen, you know, customized solution for your home versus going out to the big big macro down the road and buying the LG or whatever product I'm buying from them. And I kind of look at this and I go, so scale might play nicely at the, let's call it on the price, at a price point, but people will still like the competitiveness and the competitive positioning of, let's call it a one-off item that never is going to repeat anywhere else, never going to be created anywhere else. It's unique. It's one of a kind. Does that also not give you a bit of a competitive advantage? I create something that I only create once. I install it or build it or whatever, and once it's done, it's done.
I guess there's a certain market, hey?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's in a niche market. So
okay. So it's about the market.
Yeah, and there's no Harley that's alike. So I think definitely for the niche market. But coming back to your Walmart example, I mean, one is mass and scale, and maybe another one is proximity. And I think we've seen an extraordinary growth in the Woolworths food outlets in suburban South Africa in the last decade. And that's quality, accessibility, in and out quickly, where I don't want to go to a strip mall or a large center, but I want to go to my local Woolies to just get some items. And I know that every veggie and bundle of fruit that I buy is going to be edible and lost.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, what about competitive advantage in terms of things like customer lock-in? I mean, we see scenarios where, I mean, let's take telecommunications, banking. Very difficult to move from one brand to the other.
That's not what F&B says. They say it's easy.
Okay. Have you ever tried to switch a debit order? Good luck.
I'm still not doing it. My instinct tells me it's still difficult to switch.
Huh? Yeah. So, does customer lock-in by itself give you a competitive advantage if you just make it so hard to leave or so hard to switch? I mean, is that a strategy?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, it's almost a negative strategy, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't leave
because I can't. I mean, the bank that I'm with now, I really have found many reasons why I want to leave them. But I haven't, because I'm locked in and I kind of say, well, every bank's going to be like this, I guess. But now I'm not, I don't love being there.
Yeah, let's go back to our Apple world. So if I'm working with an Apple for 5 years and I built up a substantial iTunes library and bought a good amount of apps over the time, there's a lock-in
example. I've never thought of that.
There's a lock-in factor. So am I going to now hop over to Google Music or change that? But I think what those guys are working at, though, is that I want to stay with my Apple product.
Yeah.
I want to stay with my Apple product. So, and going back to your bank scenario, is one bank offering something uniquely different? Where I think Apple is offering something unique. Mm-hmm. I want to keep going back for the next phone, the next iPad or whatever it might be. So, I guess you're going to have to stay fresh and current and that your loyalist doesn't become resentful.
Richard, it's a difficult topic because we're in a society where brand is becoming a big thing, right?
Yeah, we talked about that earlier, yeah.
Yeah, so if I want to create my own restaurant, I compete against a whole range of brands. Mug and Bean, where people think Ocean Basque, they just think it's on top of mind and that's where I go to. So if I miss that, sorry, but how do I, as a small business, start a little restaurant and I actually compete with a whole chain? Or I start a little shop and I compete with the big boys? Or I start a small consulting business, I compete with a big consulting? We're in that world where SMEs are crucial to build jobs, create jobs, to make an economy pump and work. But yet we're a brand-focused business. So how do I compete? And I guess that's where the customized come from and that sort of thing.
Mm. Yes, I think it's bringing different things to the party. So So going back to your Mug and Bean example, we know that if we go on holiday anywhere in South Africa, I know that if I sit down for some breakfast, it's going to be consistent. And even that we'll go to fast food like McDonald's. I'm sure if you didn't know what was on the Chinese restaurant billboard, you'd go to
McDonald's.
I've done that. So interestingly, my experience with McDonald's in China was I could comfortably eat the breakfasts there, because that was kind of consistent. But they actually have an Asian option on their menu. Almost they've created a menu that has Asian spin to it for China. And, yes, there's the Big Macs and the Quarter Pounders and all this other stuff that you expect to see. But then there's some other interesting things on their menu. And you kind of go, I wonder what that is. So, yeah, it's interesting to watch how brands adjust to circumstances in the environment. Now, what happens? And I mean, I've often asked this question, let's license something. Franchises, licensing, that sort of thing. Does that put up the barriers? And does it create competitive advantage? I often think of things like the Famous Brands environment. They've got a whole lot of brands in their stable, and they ensure that those brands deliver consistently. If you sit down for a breakfast at Tasha's anywhere in the country, you're guaranteed to get exactly what Natasha and the team from Famous Brands wants you to get. They're very specific around how that experience happens and what it looks like. And interestingly, they allow every different store has its customized menu. Remember, there's that standard menu and the customized for that specific branch you're in. Yet everything that they do has that fine, let's call it the fine line of execution and delivery, and it's consistent. Does that exclusive licensing, let's call it franchising, branding, positioning, actually create an advantage out there from a competitiveness perspective?
I think you need to, if you're a young entrepreneur, you might want to venture out under the name of Mug and Bean or Tasha's or whatever it might be. I guess it might deal with your confidence and what your aspiration is. If you want to run a local steakhouse in your suburb and you don't aspire to make it a household name in South Africa, but you just want to have a spot that the locals frequent and everyone is known by name, then I guess you need to consider what space you want to play in.
Yeah, and what that license looks like. I must say, you raise an interesting one, because I think when it comes to steakhouses and the likes, we all have a perception of, what a steakhouse is, etc. There's a steakhouse, I'm going to punt a steakhouse here quickly, called the Thundergun Restaurant in Northcliffe. It's been there for years.
Never heard of it. Where?
It's in Northcliffe on Bairnsdale Drive, just up from Cresta. There you go. There's the pitch for them. But the reason I mentioned it is my I've got family that have since immigrated to Australia a few years ago. But when they come back to South Africa, they'd lived in the Northcliffe area, and they always want to go back to have a steak at the Thundergun. And I can't go, I'd never heard of this place before. I went there with them and was like really impressed with what I'd experienced. But what I found really interesting was they've eaten there over, let's call it 30, probably 40 years. And my aunt and uncle maintain that it has never changed. It is still the same quality, great experience, almost that exclusive licensed, never repeated anywhere else. And they will fly in from Brisbane, and the first place they want to go and have something to eat at is at the Thundergun. And I'm going, okay.
So do they refute all the principles with regards to differentiating, or whatever you call it?
Well, I'd say that they have. I'd say that they have. They have a competitive advantage, and it's not a big brand. It's not a place that everybody knows about. But their combination of just how they've got that exclusive delivery right in terms of good quality meats, good quality service, just the way they do everything gives that unique experience that is just so exclusive. Nobody's ever licensed it outside of their store, but it's given them this advantage that stood the test of time. And over time, as I've spoken to other people who have lived in that sort of area, it's like a local, let's call it the local steakhouse. Anybody who lived in that environment knows all about it. Why? Because it's that exclusive license that just cannot be repeated anywhere else. Okay, so some interesting learnings there. Just in closing, how do you make sure that you don't have a disruptor come along and wipe out your sustainable advantage.
Can you even do that today? I mean, it's,
you know, I don't know if you read in The Economist just 2 weeks ago that one of the big disruptors at the moment, Uber, have actually had to compromise their aspirations in China because they've actually done a JV with Didi now. And the two major factors is that they were very slow to move off the Google Maps platform. Contradictory to the Google Maps.
So, there's your problem. Uber, no Google Map.
Yeah.
Go on, do.
And paying. They wanted to still use the credit card system off the app, but the Chinese didn't want to pay in that way, and they wanted to. Is it WeChat? The big Chinese, yeah, they wanted to pay over WeChat. So interesting that that even some of the ultimate disruptors compromised at the end because they weren't cracking or getting the insight into the Chinese market.
Mm. Well, that's it for the day. Thank you, Ian. Thank you for your time. I trust that everybody now has a better understanding of the concept of sustainable competitive advantage. Definitely some of the things to consider as you engage in a business operation. So thank you very much.
Great pleasure. Thanks,
if you're interested in joining our live SME audience, contact Kevin at Leadership Platform. That's double P in the middle, leadershipplatform.com. Next up, we're going to get a little bit more practical with our SME development conversation. Our guest, Gary Crooks from Shadowball, will be joining us.
This is CliffCentral.com.